Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey and Shad here, your host for this weekend's edition, also your host throughout the week on our website, kereport.com, and podcast, The KE Report. On this weekend show, we're going to focus a lot more on the resource sector. I know it was a busy week with a lot of central bank meetings, including the Fed, and we covered those throughout the week on daily editorials. So again, if you want to comment on those, if you want to see what our guests had to say about all the central bank meetings and market reactions, go back and listen to the daily editorials. This weekend show, as I said, focused more on resource investing, especially driving down into the stocks. We are starting the show off with Joe Mazumdar, editor of Exploration Insights. Now, Joe, we saw you at the recent conferences in Vancouver. There was the Metals Investor Forum, also the Vancouver Resource Investment Conference, and the AME Conference, all back to back to back in Vancouver. First and foremost, Joe, your takeaway from the conferences, what did you think this year?
Well, thank you for inviting me for the first one of the year. So for me, the conferences in Vancouver started with me conducting a capital markets for geologists, geoscientists, as a precursor to the AME conference. And that happened on the Thursday, Friday prior to the conference. That gets me good insight into the next generation of up-and-coming geologists, geoscientists that might end up being, you know, CEOs of the next round of junior companies or beyond. And that course is basically teaching them about the capital market. So how do they raise money? How does the company that they're looking at, if they're looking at M&A, raise money? How do they impact, how do they get impacted by the markets? How do people look at buys and sells? What is the sell side? What is the buy side? All of that. We've been doing this short course for about 5 years now, I think. It's a really good venue for people to learn about the capital markets, because we talk about the capital markets because that's what we do. But there's a lot of people that work in the industry that don't understand still, who are technical, how the capital markets work. How do the companies they work for raise money? And so that's what that course is about. And then I went straight to the Metals Investment Forum. And I thought that was very well attended in terms of people and attendees. And then we had the VRIC over the weekend, and definitely what stood out to me was the lack of gray hair. We were just commenting, and so the way I do it is that if it's hard to find Brent in the audience, then I know that's probably not a good thing. And this year it wasn't hard to find him. The number of companies might be less, but that's a trend that's been continuing from last year due to people's budgets, because the financing risk for these companies really hasn't changed that much. And then going into the AME roundup, some people were telling me, you know, there was a lot of contractors and consultants, and that venue part took a lot of the actual stands at the AME. But again, most of the conferences were well attended from the time that I was there.
Well, Joe, just being at all those conference season kickoffs at all three of those events, or four if you count the one before the Metals Investor Forum, were there any commodities that were standing out as getting a lot of traction, or any that were standing out that were just kind of dead in the water? Which ones do you think were getting the traction with investors in the discussions you had?
Well, a lot of people asking about uranium. I mean, obviously that was one of the best performing commodities last year, up over 80%. But interestingly, the uranium equities didn't do as well. So they're not showing any leverage. And so the idea is like, well, where's the split here between the two? I mean, we saw the same thing in gold for different reasons. And more people are into the uranium ETFs, like the Sprott one and other ones, to get direct exposure to uranium without taking a chance on a producer that might not generate a big margin, or a developer that might need multi-billion dollars to start up their project, or an explorer that may or may not hit uranium intersection. They're going straight to the commodity. And that's probably, as an investor, if you're first time into this market and you're thinking, well, you know, this sector is really undercapitalized. You know, hey, I read what these guys at COP28 want to do with, you know, with nuclear power. They want to triple it. You know, there doesn't seem to be enough of it. The price is shooting up, you know, and then we have this market segmentation that, and then Kazakhstan is putting out that their production is going to be, they're going to have a shortfall of production because of sulfuric acid. And I don't know if it was labor availability or whatever. And then the other problem is this foreign ownership interest that if Russians or the Chinese control more than 25% of an asset, then that asset, you know, can't be sold. The product can't be sold in the U.S. That could impact Kazakhstan production. I don't know. But all that is making uranium very interesting. But, you know, the first level of invest would probably be the commodity if you can get it without doing a deep dive on individual companies and that. And I think that's what we're seeing. Then people would have to get in, you know, comfortable with the companies. Because if you're really bullish on uranium, you know, you probably are not investing in that Kazakh producer because they're producing less of it. And Cameco has actually gone more downstream than, you know, they are increasing their production out of Cigar Lake and some of their other operations in Athabasca Basin. But, you know, it's not a big growth profile by any means. So, you know, that exposure is going to be interesting. And I think probably rightfully so, they sought it first with the commodity.
In all fairness, though, Joe, we have seen a number of uranium companies do quite well. It's really been, I think, the one of the only standouts for a lot of investors in the space that always hold a wide range of commodities. What about something like copper, though? Because copper, we keep on hearing about this bullish case for copper, and copper continues to be a number of people's number one pick for the year, the same as last year, though. Hasn't really seemed to get running in terms of the copper price, nor have the stocks gotten running. What did you hear on the copper front? What do you think about copper?
So I am one of those. I fall into that bucket of people that were bullish on copper last year and continue to be bullish. The issue about copper is on the demand side and the, you know, the probability of global a slowdown with all the, you know, the geopolitical crises might have a negative impact on global growth. And most of the predictions of the GDP is supposed to go down in 2024 versus 2023. So less GDP growth, less industrial production means potentially less demand for industrial metals like copper. So copper in the near term, you know, is not doing well. But importantly, it's setting us up because the incentive price isn't there for people to build. The incentive price isn't there for people to expand and reinvest. And so the supply surpluses, I mean, sort of the balance surpluses that people had, you know, forecasted for 2024 are now turning into late 2024 deficits. And why is that? Is because we're not seeing that production come up. No, we've seen Codelco basically revert to production profiles that we haven't seen in a couple of decades when they were ramping up. We saw Cobre Panama, 1 to 1.5% of total global production being taken off the market. We're seeing other people having problems starting projects, whether it's Resolution in Arizona, you know, the Pebble Project in Alaska, you know, and forcing people like Barrick to go to Pakistan to develop projects. You know, QB2 is being built, but the overruns on capital there have basically scared probably other producers into expanding their own projects. And so all that production that we thought was going to come online isn't coming online, but we still are, you know, making this carbon neutral world that requires electrification, that requires copper. So that intensity of demand is still out there. But then where is that copper going to come from? Because at least we can put our finger on the fact that, you know, if we don't start doing something now, it's not going to be there. And that's what continues to make me bullish about copper. And so copper is one commodity I'm willing to go from exploration, development, and production on to get leverage to it.
Well, Joe, just one takeaway. I'd like to float this idea by you from these conferences and really just over the last year or two is that in something like copper, the producers have actually done pretty well. If you look at the COPEX, made up of mostly copper producers, over a 3 to 5 year period, it's actually held up pretty well, held on to most of the gains. A lot of those companies, some of them are near 52-week highs still. And same thing with uranium. It was the producers that really ran more than the explorers. Same thing in gold. Even over the last year or two, it's been a tough sector, but we saw a lot of double-digit and even triple-digit gains in some of the mid-tiers and smaller gold and silver producers, but we're not seeing that trickle down into the developers and explorers. Is it just a market where the producers are getting the love and we'll eventually see that catch up in developers and explorers, but have investors been better served to avoid exploration stocks?
So in terms of like whenever a commodity goes up, the first leverage provided and the liquidity, you know, that's provided also by these companies, their producers, is the first one to go. So that's exactly where you would see most of it, because, I mean, if you're Alamos or whatever, intermediate producer, major producer, you know, you don't care really, maybe because of your share price. You don't care if the central banks are buying gold as long as the gold price is going up, because the bottom line is that your revenue is going to go up. If you produce the same amount, you're getting paid 15-20% more. You know, that's a positive. That's not the case for a developer. You're not getting paid anything. You know, is the finance environment any better? That's your primary concern. And the problem is the financing environment for gold projects is still not good for development projects. And it's not good for explorers. More people are interested in critical minerals. And critical minerals have more access to capital from governments, private equity, and some other forms. I think some, I hate to call it the smart money, but some people have seen this in the precious metals and are looking at that as a window of opportunity in terms of some precious metals developers and some developers as a sector, to saying that not only is our sector undervalued, but this is a certain component in our sector that is highly undervalued because there's no access to capital for the equity component that's required to develop this project. It doesn't exist. Even if they get 70-75% from the debt markets and a stream, let's say, or whatever, they can't ever get that other 25%. It doesn't exist out there. So that, for me, potentially, you know, generates an opportunity for those who are contrarians right now. And the best of those projects, I think, will find that contrarian funding. You know, but in terms of copper, what we'll see, and we have seen, is M&A for production, just like we've seen in gold. The question is, do we see that M&A now spill over into development? And I don't know if the incentive price right now is there, because you buy this project and then you have to build it. And we have seen that probably the copper price right now is not high enough to incentivize these people to build projects. And so they're holding off on acquiring development projects right now. And so the development project that I hold in copper, I'm convinced, right or wrong, that they could build it themselves and they have actually access to capital to build it themselves.
Yeah, that's been so critical, that access to capital. We hear all these companies say how they're going to fund builds, and it's taking into account 3-4 different sources of funding. And unfortunately, they don't seem to be coming together. Just circling back around two precious metal stocks then, because look, the mid-tiers have done pretty well, or at least the select mid-tiers have done well. The majors continue to struggle. The juniors, there's almost a non-existent interest in these stocks. You mentioned how that can be a contrarian play, but look, we've also heard that these stocks were cheap last year. Even 2 years ago, they were cheap compared to where the gold mostly the gold price was. What finally gets them moving if we're not even seeing the majors move?
A sentiment will be important. And sentiment was changing the latter part of last year, because I think we discussed this before, that, you know, a lot of people were convinced, and me as well, that real rates had peaked. So if real rates had peaked, then that's positive for gold. But then the trend has to be down. The gold price, the real rates have to trend down, and that will help gold price sentiment. The problem is, over the last couple of weeks, not knowing if the Fed was going to cut. And you know, the beginning of the year or the end of last year, people were predicting, you know, up to 6 cuts in interest rates in 2024. The number of those cuts and the amount, the absolute amount of those cuts has reduced because the U.S. economy isn't doing that bad. So if the U.S. economy is doing good or okay, which it is, it's over 3% growth year on year, and the inflation as measured by, let's say, core personal consumption expenditures, PCE, is 2 to 2.5% around the Fed target, then there's no reason to cut rates or no reason to cut them anytime soon, And so if that's the sentiment, then real rates won't nosedive. And if real rates don't nosedive, then people will take their foot off the accelerator with respect to gold.
Well, Joe, just maybe one more thing it would be nice to share with our audiences. You have a background working with majors, evaluating the up and coming projects. And while we don't have time to take a deep dive into it, you're working on some proprietary models that you'll share with your subscribers. But just in a general sense, what are some of the key criteria that you would look at when you're trying to evaluate, let's say, an up and coming advanced explorer with a deposit that may be defined or getting close to defined, or a development stage company? What are some of the things that you would help narrow down the field and really make those companies look more attractive in the eyes of a major?
Okay, ignoring, let's say, the capital structure and just looking at, let's say, the value, the X that we're trying to determine, like what could this be? And that's always a question about retail. They don't want to know downside. They just want to know what could this be? Because these people are risk lovers, it's a lottery ticket. How big is this thing could be? And so what we'd look at is saying, okay, what is the analog for this deposit style in the area that they are in? And what's the probability that they could find something like that? That would be your exploration upside. They could find another one, theirs could be bigger, or theirs could be smaller, something like that. And then once you know the details of the analog, then you could say, well, the jurisdiction, that a deposit could be built there because there's one right there. And then you would look at the risks to your thesis that it could be something like that. Then you could look at, is the metallurgy the same? Do we know that? Is it more remote than the other? Is it have a social license to operate issue? Something like that. All the things that would make somebody who might consider buying the project say, I don't think I'll buy this one. And so that's something you want to know. I mean, the stock could still go up and you could still do really well, but what you don't want to do is keep holding it and ride it down the other side. You want to know, well, I knew this was going to be a problem, so that's why I sold. I might not have sold at the peak, but I knew that, I'd made a nice return and now this other stuff would be coming out soon. And that's going to be a problem for this company. So that's the sort of stuff we want to put together in this rate and rank tool that me and this friend of mine, who now is a prof to my alumni at Colorado School of Mines, that put together for Newmont back in the 2000s. I hadn't dusted that thing off since that time. And I did that capital markets course, and on my day two presentation was about this management tool in terms of how to look at assets. And from a risk and reward perspective.
How do you go about comparing assets too then, Joe? Because this portfolio management tool, everyone always has that question, right? Do I sell this to buy this?
Yeah, and the thing is that what the whole idea was to put in these various categories of reward, whether it be, what's the resource, what's the potential, valuation NPV-wise, what could be the IRR, what could be the life of mine ounces on this, a whole bunch of different factors that at that time in the 2000s with Newmont, we aligned with the key performance indicators for executives. So they were doing exactly what they were paid to do in terms of when they made a capital decision. So you could take that tool and apply it to your own things that you're looking for. If you emphasize resource upside, that would be the category that you weigh the most on. If you are very concerned about geopolitical risk, that would be a category you weigh very highly. And then you could look at that and say, well, I have this other deposit that's not worth as much as this one in terms of upside, but on the risk side, it's a lot easier because I don't have XYZ in terms of problems. One thing I've also looked at is, how much it costs to drill. So, I was just noting that now in Nevada and in a lot of places in the Great Basin in the States, now it's costing, up to $600 in places per meter for core to drill, which is quite high. Taking you back to when GT Gold was drilling Saddle North several years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, they were paying about $380 to $400 per meter Canadian. Now we're at $500 to $600 US drilling in a place that you have road access and you don't need a helicopter. So those costs have gone up. And then take that and say, well, what does it cost in Alaska? What does it cost in the Yukon? What does it cost in all these remote areas? Because if money is hard to get, bang for buck, I'm going to get less drilling. And that's a concern to me. Like to say, okay, well, they can't drill it as much as I want, so we could drill it less, less chance of getting a decent intersection where they can come back to the capital markets and raise more money, hopefully at a higher price than what I came in at. So that's another thing I'm watching.
Okay. Well, there's a lot to watch in this market right now, right, Joe? Because unfortunately, well, outside of uranium and uranium stocks, there hasn't really been much moving. So I think everyone's trying to weigh their portfolio and say, is this better than something else that they have in their portfolio? And what is the upside outside of just simply better sentiment, which could lift all stocks? So, hey, it's a tough market out there still, but some positive takeaways from the recent investment conferences, especially being the fact that it sounds like there were some younger people on the floor, just even through that data. We'll see if that carries over to any market action. Joe, thank you very much for your time. If you want to follow along with Joe, you need to go visit the Exploration Insights website and check out that new portfolio management tool when Joe releases it. It could really help you manage your portfolio. Joe, again, thank you very much for joining us this weekend. Hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Great. Thanks a lot, guys.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.